Oh, the Gospel according to St. Luke, the 7th chapter. After Jesus had finished all his sayings in the hearing of the people, he entered Capernaum. A centurion there had a slave whom he valued highly and who was ill and close to death. When he heard about Jesus, he sent some Jewish elders to him, asking him to come and heal his slave. When they came to Jesus, they appealed to him earnestly, saying, "He is worthy of having you do this for him, for he loves our people, and it is he who built our synagogue for us." And Jesus went with them. But when he was not far from the house, the centurion sent friends to say to him, "Lord, do not trouble yourself, for I am not worthy to have you come under my roof. Therefore, I did not presume to come to you, but only speak the word and let my servant be healed. For I also am a man set under authority, with soldiers under me. And I say to one, 'Go,' and he goes, and to another, 'Come,' and he comes, and to my slave, 'Do this,' and the slave does it." When Jesus heard this, he was amazed at him, and turning to the crowd that followed him, he said, "I tell you, not even in Israel have I found such faith." When those who had been sent returned to the house, they found the slave in good health. The Gospel of the Lord. Who is worthy? Why don't we get to the point and ask what the question is behind that question? Who is worthy? Another way to ask that question is, who do you personally think deserves Jesus' attention? And each one of you will have a set of criteria in your mind and in your heart of who deserves Jesus' attention and who does not. Let's ask the real question. Who do you think deserves the attention of God? The question, who is worthy, comes from the gospel text today. We learn from the centurion that he does not think that he is worthy, that as Jesus approaches his house, he says, "I am not worthy for Jesus to be in my house under my roof." We learn that the Jewish elders of the community do think the centurion is worthy. They say he's worthy because of two things. One, he loves the people in his community. And second, he is the one that made sure that their synagogue got built. So he meets the standards of being worthy. We then ask the question, so which set of standards apply? Jesus answers that question for us. Neither one. It's not about self-deprecation. It's not about lifting up one's resume. But what makes him fit in the eyes of God is that this is a man who has faith. Golda Meir was the prime minister of Israel from 1969 to 1974. She was known for, among many of her character traits, being someone who always put everything out on the table. She had in her cabinet a young man who at a cabinet meeting kept making self-deprecating comments to himself. And you've all met people like that. They keep putting themselves down because their goal is to get you to compliment them. Say, "Well, you know, I'm really not that good." "Oh, Pastor, you are that good." "Well, the sermon wasn't really that good." "Oh, Pastor, it was brilliant." And she finally reached her limit with this staff member. And she looked at him and she said, "Don't be humble. You're not that good." Don't be humble. You're not that good. the pride of thinking too highly of ourselves or the timidity of thinking too lowly of ourselves are both distorted self-perceptions. What makes a centurion worthy in the eyes of Jesus is that he has received the faith that God has given to him. What is it about this man's character that allows him to receive and accept the faith that God has given to him? The centurion describes himself as one who has oversight over 80 to 100 soldiers, and he has authority over those soldiers so that if he tells one to go and do this, the soldier will immediately go and perform the task. If he says to the other soldier, come here and do this, the soldier will do that. Likewise, his household staff is the same way. He understands authority. And I think that is the quality of his character that allows him to have room for faith. To understand authority is to be willing to allow room for the reality that each one of us answers to something greater than our own feelings, our own life experiences, and our own personal values. And it's that openness to something larger than himself that allows him to have a faith in a God who is bigger than him. We hear the phrase, I'm not a religious person, bandied about a lot. One definition I've given you in the past of the word religion, that to which one is bound. Another definition that recently appeared in a Dan Brown novel is that to which one is connected. So to say, I'm not a religious person, I'm not bound to anything, or I'm not connected to anything. And so whenever we have come in front of us a person who disagrees with us, who makes us uncomfortable, who challenges us, we look at that person with contempt because that presence of that person is threatening. It is threatening because that person's very presence asks us to consider that we are answerable to something larger than ourselves. So what do you do to shut down the person who challenges you? Stories came out of Nazi Germany of the experience of German citizens during those times, particularly those that lived near the concentration camps. And one person says that they knew that near their village was a concentration camp. They knew as the trains went in and they heard the crying and the yelling from the train where those people on the train were heading. They knew that every Sunday morning as they gathered in worship and they heard the train, they were going to hear the screams of the Jewish people in the train as they went behind the church. And she said, this is what we did every Sunday when the train approached. When we heard the whistle, when we heard the train approaching, we started singing a hymn. The closer the train got, the louder we sang so that we didn't have to hear the cries for help. Christians have the capacity, through their own religious practices, and through their beliefs, to shut the truth out and bring harm to other people. But those who are not Christian have the same capacity. Whether you're humanist, whatever your life approach, we resist the power of the truth and shut it out with whatever technique we have at our disposal. But the truth calls us to an authority greater than any single one of us. The centurion had faith because he allowed room for authority. What kind of faith did this centurion have? We first of all understand that the faith of this centurion was that he was afraid of God. Don't allow Jesus to come into my house. I'm afraid to have him under my roof for fear of what will happen if he stands in my midst. But there's another side of his faith that also shows up, which is his hope that by Jesus saying the word, his slave will be healed. His faith had the hope that God could do something to make things change. It's what's called in philosophy Pascal's bargain, that you may not really believe in God, but you publicly say you believe in God because you consider the alternatives. What if God is real, and I say I don't believe in God? I'll end up burning in hell. So I might as well say I believe in God just in case that happens to be true. And our faith too often is rooted solely in what we are afraid will happen. My wife and I were first married. We lived in the church parsonage. It was not the nicest of houses, because the congregation my wife served spent more time on the building than they did on the parsonage. There were two particular features of the house that were frustrating to us. Number one, it did not have central air conditioning, and on days like this, it made it very difficult to even be in the house. Second, whenever it rained hard, the lower level of the house would flood with as much as an inch of water. There will be times if you look behind the doors in the areas that had carpet, there would be mushrooms growing up out of the carpet. We thought about a cottage industry to maybe help pay for air conditioning in the house. So when it came time as we made a move to buy our first house, these were the two criteria. It has to have air conditioning, and the basement has to be dry, because we didn't want to have to go through it again. And we picked a house that had central air conditioning and had a dry basement. But it wasn't the house that we wanted. It was the house that wasn't like the first one. So in another move, in another purchase of a house, we got a house that was dry in the basement, had air conditioning, and was larger, but still not the right house because it was a new construction. There were no trees. There was no grass. There was no shrubbery. There was no shade. You were not outside during the summer. It took 17 years for wisdom to kick in, and so when we moved to Lancaster to buy our house here in Lancaster, we not only asked the question, what do we want to avoid, but we finally got smart enough to say, what do we want in a house? And we bought a house that we love because it's more than just a house that's different than the first one. We can fall into that trap with our faith as well, that our faith is simply avoiding negative consequences. But the centurion demonstrates to us a faith that also hopes for new possibilities. To whom is that faith given? In the fourth chapter of the Gospel of Luke, Jesus, teaching in his hometown, uses the story of the widow of Zarephath and also the story of Naaman the Syrian to point out that God also blesses those who aren't considered believers. And he claims that he has come to reach out not only to Israel, but to all people of the earth. In chapter 7, which was the gospel reading for today, we see a God who reaches out even to those who are not part of the faith community in the form of the centurion and his slave. At the conclusion of the Gospel of Luke, It's the centurion after Jesus dies who makes the boldest faith claim ever. Surely this man was the Son of God. And it points us right then to the 10th chapter of the book of Acts, where Cornelius receives the gift of the Holy Spirit and is blessed by the presence of God. That faith is not reserved for an insider's club, but that faith is made available to all people on the face of the earth. All people. I just completely forgot my next point. Remember what the story was next? Thank you. Very good. See, so I'm glad people take notes during the sermon. Thank you. Obviously, there's help for all people as well. In ancient mythology, there is a story of the Procrustean bed. And Procrustes is a man who lived along a road that was highly traveled. And what he did along that road was offered shelter for the travelers at night. And what he would say to the travelers was, come into my house at night, and I have a bed that will be perfect for your size. It's a magic bed that adjusts to whoever comes into the house. Well, once the person came into the house, they realized that the bed was not magic. It didn't change size. What Procrustes did was adjusted the person to the bed. So if you were too short for the bed, he had a way to stretch you out. If you were too long for the bed, a dilemma that I would face, he would trim you down to size. Unfortunately, I think the church can fall into that same trap when it comes to dealing with people who are different than us. To force people into our narrow and limited views of God. The way we can step out of that trap is through Christian witness. A witness that begins by welcoming and hospitality. When we see someone new come into our midst, how do we greet that person? If that person is seated in your assigned pew number, certain of you know what your pew number is. Will you ask that person to move so you can sit in your pew? And I know the cushion is perfectly shaped now to your backside, but will you show that hospitality? Will you take the risk if someone comes up to you and says, are you a visitor and you've been a member for 50 years, not to get your dander up, but allow room for hospitality and welcome? Witness is about moving from welcoming to invitation, to take the risk to invite people to join you and to be part of worship with you. And witness is also about testifying to your faith with others who may not fit your standards of what makes a good person. So identify for yourself the people that you don't think are worthy of Jesus' attention. We all have that list. And this week, take the risk to establish a relationship with someone who fits that category. Take the risk to talk to a liberal this week. take the risk to talk to a conservative this week. Take the risk to talk to a family member that you refuse to spend time with anymore. Take a risk to talk to the person that makes you so uncomfortable as soon as you see her. And witness to the people for whom Christ offers the gift of faith. Amen.